Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Well, that sounds familiar. We already heard that sting once before. But kia ora, MOTAT, and kia ora, Alan. How is it going?
It's going very well. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, we're going to let Felix is going to take the lead on these questions a bit here, but I can get the ball rolling if we want. I hear the first story, the average body temperature has dropped. What's going on there?
Yeah, good question. And something I'd never really thought about until I saw this in the literature the other day. So we're all familiar with your body temperature, what it should be, what it's meant to be, is 37.0 degrees Celsius. Or if you work in the old currency, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, which unfortunately this whole paper was gauged in, unfortunately, all of these Fahrenheits and things like that. But anyway, we're going to stick to Celsius. So where did this come from is the first question. Why 37.0 degrees? How long have we known this? And it dates back, in fact, to 1868 and a German physician by the name of Karl Wunderlich. And he went and wrote a book which described his studies of, get this, 1 million temperature readings from around about 25,000 patients. And he had a special thermometer they did this with, and it was about a couple of feet long or something like that. So this big, enormous, you know, not the sort of thing that you sort of, you know, easily slip under your tongue these days. And so that was basically the guts of his findings, was that, yep, the average human body temperature is 37.0 degrees. He realized that you did get some variation, obviously, during the day. And so it ranges from, or as he said, 36.2 degrees to 37.5 degrees. It's coldest in the middle of the night, so from 2 to 8 a.m. is when your body temperature is the lowest, and it's the highest from 4 to 9 p.m. So there's some sort of, yeah, variation there. And so part of why he wanted to do this was, obviously, we all know that when we get sick, we get hot, our temperature increases, and we get a fever. And so he was one of the first to recognize that the fever itself was not the problem, that the fever was more a symptom than a disease, and that the fever actually is a sign that your body is busy trying to fight an infection, some sort of an infection, and so that sort of mobilizes your T cells and stuff like that, and, you know, gets your body going and your whole immune system, etc., etc., etc. And so that's been the case for the past, what is it, 150 odd years, this 37 degrees. However, there have been recent studies, a couple of recent studies. So in 2017, they did a study in the UK of 35,000 adults, and they found that the average body temperature there was 36.6 degrees Celsius. Mm. And a similar study in the States last year, 2019, they found an average body temperature of 36.4 degrees Celsius. And you might think, well, whoop-de-doo, you know, so what? You know, what difference does 0.6 of a degree Celsius make? And, well, you know, it is kind of interesting. Why has the average body temperature over the past 150 or so years dropped by, you know, about 1.4 degrees Celsius? That's, you know, an interesting enough question to have a look for an answer to. And so what a multinational team of workers started doing, in fact, I think 16 or so years ago, was that they started studying a group of Tsimani Amerindians who live in Bolivia. And they are sort of forager farmer people. And this was a multinational study, people in the US and Bolivia and the EU. And amongst other things, they were interested in measuring the body temperature of these folks. And so when this started, in around about the year 2000-ish, it was found that their average body temperature was 37.0 degrees Celsius, just like, you know, supposedly the rest of the world. And what they've found over the intervening, or nearly intervening, two decades was, in fact, a similar drop in body temperature, in average body temperature, down to around about 36.5 degrees Celsius. And that's really interesting because their average temperature has dropped over a span of about 20 years, whereas it's taken sort of the rest of the world sort of 200 years, or, you know, 150 or so years, for their body temperature to decrease by that much. And so, therefore, the obvious question is,
why?
Indeed. Wow. You know, they're seeing a decline in their body temperature of 0.05 degrees Celsius a year. which might not sound like a hell of a lot, but you add that up over a few years, and it is, in fact, quite a bit. Yeah, yeah. So, why? They've got the data now. So, you know, there's three studies, and they had thought that probably the decline in the body temperatures measured in the UK and in the States, you know, the so-called Western countries, must be due to sort of the Western lifestyle, you know, those sorts of things. And they weren't really fully expecting to see a similar sort of thing happening with these Bolivians.
Right, yeah. I wanted to ask, might this have something to do with external temperatures rising because of things like climate change? Do you think that could have some sort of influence? Or?
That's a good question. They did look at things like sort of the fact that the Western countries have got access to things like air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And so they live in a much more temperature-controlled climate.
It's just quite curious that you say the past 20 years among this group that were studied, it's accelerated, but that sort of lines up with the time where we've seen, you know, big impacts from climate change.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I don't recall actually seeing that in the paper. I don't think they mentioned that as a possible reason for this or a cause of this. What they did say was that it could very possibly be due to something like antibiotics and the fact that there's an increasing prevalence of antibiotics all around the world. So that may have something to do with it. But what they were expecting, they obviously were expecting the Bolivian cohort would have more diseases than the Western, the so-called Western cohort. And so therefore, they should have more inflammation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, more diseases, more inflammation, and so therefore their body temperature shouldn't be dropping. But it is, and so therefore that sort of says that inflammation and the immune activation that occurs is not influencing the average body temperature. And so they reckon antibiotics, that might be happening because that obviously reduces infection. Antibiotics are ubiquitous around the world now, you know. And what antibiotics can actually do is they can kill off some of your microbiome in your gut, your gut bugs. Mm. And those bugs, when they're active, they actually give out heat. And so therefore, that could be a cause. If you're killing them off, then that could be a cause of decreasing temperature. So, and that was consistent with the fact that at the very, very start of the study, when they were studying the Bolivian cohort, they found that a particular respiratory illness that they would get would increase their temperature by a certain amount. But then sort of 5-10 years down the track, that very, very same respiratory illness wouldn't have the same effect and it would only increase the temperature, you know, so they'd get a much milder fever. And, you know, this is, in fact, a study without an answer, which is nice because, you know, this is one of those ones where more study is required, obviously.
You love to see it.
But I think that's absolutely fascinating. Mm. You know, why? I think if anybody can answer that definitively, then, you know, there's that would be quite a big thing to actually
Send
be
us
able
a text
explain.
If you've got an answer.
Please.
Was it 5395?
5395.
Yeah, so there you go.
All right, we'd better move on to this liquid window that can save energy. What's the deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, again, when I'm reading up for these Dear Science segments, I always am amazed by something every week, you know. And so today's amazing one is that buildings, from a 2009 UN study, buildings account for 40% of global energy usage. Buildings. Mm. That's astonishing. I had no idea.
From heating and
just everything and, you know, electricity and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, 40%, the building of the buildings, et cetera, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So buildings themselves, 40%. And windows are responsible for half of that.
Mm.
So we'd be a hell of a sight better position if we didn't have windows in our buildings.
Huh. Depends from which perspective you look at that.
And, you know, and I was thinking about that and I thought, yeah, good point. Igloos don't have windows, do they?
Mm.
You know? Because it would just be silly to. But we need our windows, obviously. We need to see out. And so obviously we're going to have to find a better way of making windows because that's an enormous energy consumption. That's huge. So there's work obviously going on in this area, so-called smart windows and things like that, that can sort of let in some light and not let in other light and et cetera, et cetera. And obviously If you're letting in too much visible light, you're getting heating up inside, and you know that's not necessarily going to be a good thing. So you're going to need your air conditioning on because it's going to get too hot inside. But then if your windows aren't big enough, then it's not going to warm it up enough inside, and it's going to be too cold, and so you're going to have to heat up the, you know, etc. So, so what these workers in Singapore have done is to say, right, let's use water for our windows. So let's take a couple of panes of glass. We're going to fill them up with the space between them with water, plus a little additive. And this little additive is going to make all the difference, okay? And this additive is called a hydrogel. And that's sort of a polymeric material that can be very responsive to visible light. And in particular, heat. And what happens is that they make these windows with this aqueous solution between them. When it gets too hot, they go opaque and they stop the visible light coming in and heating up the inside of the building. When they cool down, they go clear. And the big thing about water is it's got a very high heat capacity. Okay, I don't know if you've sort of ever noticed this, but it really does take a lot of energy to heat up water. Okay, so hence the name heat capacity. It's got a big capacity for heat. You've got to put a lot of heat in there to raise the temperature by a little bit. And conversely, when it's losing heat, it's very difficult for it to lose heat. It holds heat very well, which is why the oceans keep the Earth basically livable, right? Because that's an enormous heat sink that is very, very difficult to heat up and very, very difficult to cool down. And so that's the basis of these sort of smart window things, these water windows. And they have found significant energy savings in mock-ups of these things and prototypes, up to sort of around about 11% or so over the very best sort of smart windows that we've got at the moment, and huge when compared to just sort of, you know, a pane of glass sort of thing. So 30% more efficient than current energy efficient glass. And so this really is quite a big thing. You know, this could make enormous, enormous energy savings. And and another nice byproduct of it all, because your windows are filled with water, then you get noise suppression, noise reduction. Okay, so things are less noisy out there.
Yeah, with all the construction going on outside, I think we could use some of that.
And indeed, there is right outside this window here. The view has gone. I hate to say it. You cannot.
It's
now.
Quite sad
for people who can't see. There's just a big old wooden wall.
For people who can't see, everyone can see.
For those of you who can't see what it looks like in here,
but, we should move on to the last one because we don't have much more time, and
surely.
I am desperate to talk about platypuses. I don't think you understand how excited I am about this one. Platypus's fur glows in ultraviolet light.
Yep.
What the hell?
And this, again, is one of those amazing things that you'd sort of think, well, how the heck did they not come across this sooner? And you're absolutely right. So platypus fur does glow under UV light. So in scientific terms, we say it fluoresces. And this was a nice story because it was a complete accident, because there were a bunch of folk
as most important discoveries.
A bunch of folk in the States who were studying flying squirrels. And apparently flying squirrels do the same sort of thing, that they are fluorescent, so they glow under ultraviolet light. And they found this in the wild, and they went to a museum in Chicago, the Field Museum in Chicago, and they were looking for specimens of these flying squirrels. And they found a few pelts and stuff like that, and they shone an UV light on them and found that, yes, they do indeed fluoresce. And then they were sort of looking in the neighbouring drawers and seeing what they had in there and stuff like that. So they found they had some marsupials and stuff, so they were looking for marsupials because apparently they do that as well. And there just happened to be a platypus in there as well. And so they went and shone the old ultraviolet light on this platypus, and surprise, surprise, it started fluorescing. So... in addition, the platypus being one of the weirdest things on planet
Nature's
Earth.
Nature's greatest freaks.
So it's got these electrical sensors in its beak that can, or its bill, whatever you want to call it, that can detect electrical signals from its prey. It's one of the very few venomous mammals. And
it lays
eggs. I mean, you know, it's just a bizarre thing. And now to this long litany of weirdness, we can add the fact that it glows in ultraviolet light. And again, which obviously begs the question, why?
Yeah.
Because you know, in nature, things don't just be. You know, there's got to be a reason.
Because it looks cool.
it's a fashion statement.
Where's the ultraviolet that they're going to fluoresce in? You know, that's the thing. There's not a heck of a lot of ultraviolet light in nature. So why? And so people were sort of saying, well, it might perhaps, if you've got predators that can see into the ultraviolet, if these guys are busy absorbing the ultraviolet light, then they sort of are going to become less visible to their predators. But then somebody else said, well, they don't really have any predators. They might get chomped by a crocodile occasionally, but they're pretty nasty things themselves, you know, obviously not good eating or anything like that. So they don't really have a lot of natural predators. So people are thinking, well, you know, it might not be that. It might be a recognition thing, perhaps that they can see each other. They're apparently solitary animals, and so they might see this glowing ultraviolet thing in the distance and recognise it as being another platypus.
Nice friend radar.
But again, the control experiment in this paper hasn't been done, which surely is to just go out into the WAPS, find yourself a live platypus, get yourself an ultraviolet light and see if it glows or not.
There you go. That's a fun summer project.
Fun weekend trip.
Yeah, listeners, please. Listeners in Australia. Yeah, thank you so much, though. That's probably what we've got time for today. We're to leave Dear Science there, but we'll see you again in a fortnight, Alan.
Yeah, I won't see you again in a fortnight. So
no, you won't.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, so Felix will be here.
Yeah, best of luck with everything, and it's been, as always, a blast. So,
thank you.
Yeah, hope all
goes
well.
And I'll be back.
Cool.
I'll be back.
Okay.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.